Good afternoon, everyone. I'm really sorry I couldn't be in Sheffield. At weekends, I sometimes just have to be dad. If you can't hear me at any moment, do just give me a wave or something, by the way, because I can see you. So I'm presuming I can be heard right now. Is that true?
Yes!
Brilliant. Okay, I'm Richard Murphy. For my 6th, I'm a chartered accountant. Despite that, I'm told I'm a campaigner who runs on Duracells by Kevin Maguire of the Daily Mirror. I'm not sure whether that was a compliment. I think it was meant to be. And what I've campaigned about for the last decade, basically, is tax reform, fundamentally. But that's picked up a whole load of other issues, obviously, with regard to poverty, with regard to the reform of the way in which we manage our whole fundamental market system, relationship between the state and the market, and so a whole load, host of themes that obviously have been picked up more recently by the Occupy movement. But when a lot of people in the Occupy movement talk about issues to do with the tax gap, and certainly UK Uncut have done, then quite a lot of that has been based upon the research that I've done with the Tax Justice Network over the last decade. What I've also done is thought quite heavily about my experience. I mean, I'm age 53, so I've been around for a while. I started training as a chartered accountant in 1979. And I stayed in practice as a chartered accountant quite deliberately. It was the way I wanted to run my career was first half was going to be doing it, second half was really going to be thinking and talking about it. I always intended that. First half, I ran a firm of accountants, I saw how the system worked. That's a really well wrapped up baby there. I hope realities and know quite a lot of flaws in it. I've recently written a book. I'm going to sort of hold it up in front of the camera. That's my book, The Courageous State. We're talking about alternatives to capitalism. Well, mine is, in a sense, summarized in the book, The Courageous State. What do I mean by that, the term The Courageous State? I think that neoliberalism, and I'm about as far from being a neoliberal as you can get, a long way. What I mean is that we have, for the last 30 years, suffered a system of economic thinking which has fundamentally told politicians that absolutely everything they can do, without exception, will always produce a worse outcome for us, the people who actually live in the country, than what would happen if the politicians did not interfere. So they are told that everything they do creates a market imperfection, and every market imperfection results in a situation where our net well-being is reduced. And what we've ended up with is a whole generation of what I call cowardly politicians. And it's easy to see them. They're all around us. They are in all the major political parties. And what do? They basically do spend their time trying to get the state out of doing things, passing over activity to the private sector, making sure that whatever happens, we will have our needs, while what they believe the most optimal solution, which is the market. Now, I don't agree with them. It's as simple as that. This is completely wrong. It's just not how I believe the economy should be organized. Now, I'm not actually an anti-capitalist, and when I make that clear, it would be hard to be an anti-capitalist given my past career. I could obviously have had a complete change of mind. I could have rejected everything that I've done. But if I'm honest, I haven't. I still think that actually there is a right for somebody to be able to set up a business on their own and run it and work with others to achieve the same goal. I always intended to involve everybody in the companies in which I worked, and I had a very progressive attitude, very pro-union, very pro-employee involvement, and so on. But I'll come back to that. My point is that actually I believe that we live in something which is fundamentally different from this sort of very, very black and white world that neoliberalism talks about. And that black and white world basically says, market good, state bad, therefore market does, make the state as small as possible. Yeah, I well remember having a debate. It was in Slovenia, of all places, and rather bizarrely, I was taken there by the International Monetary Fund to take part in the debate with the guy who created flat taxes, a chap called Alvin Rabushka. And I interviewed him for some research I was doing at the time and asked him, well, what should the state do in your opinion? And he said, look, the state should just run the legal system, protect the country, have a police force, end of story. no pension, private pensions, no private medicine, no private roads, no private education, no private, no state, any of those things, sorry, not no private those, any state of all those things. And I just think that's absolutely absurd. My argument is that we actually live in societies. And you know, society is something that quite simply neoliberalism doesn't recognise, doesn't think exists. And in the book, I talk about a metaphor that I use sometimes, and I'll sort of try and describe it and very vaguely sort of outline what it looks like on the screen. I think we live in what I call a cappuccino society. Cappuccino does inevitably go into cups if you buy it in a store, which sort of nice sort of bowl-shaped cups. Now, that's because it just happens to suit our type of society. You know, we don't have the same solution everywhere. I'm quite sure that there are espresso societies and there are probably latte societies, whatever else. I happen to describe what I think is, what I believe we live in, which is a cappuccino society. The point about it is that the cup is that society. It's all of us trying to live together to work out solutions communally. And if we don't, it all falls apart, is my opinion. What is the foundation of a cappuccino? It's a black coffee. That's the first thing that goes in. No black coffee, no cappuccino is the simple point. Well, in my metaphor, that is the state. Everything that we have is built upon the basis of having what I call a courageous state. It's a state that is willing to actually take the lead to build the foundations of a strong society. And that will obviously do those things that the neoliberal says, it will defend the state, but actually probably not as strongly in the way that they want. I'm certainly, I oppose their associated neoconservative ideas, of course, of what defence means, because that's aggression, that's not defence. It will establish the rules, but the rules aren't just there to protect private property, which is basically what the neoliberal view of rules is. The rules are there to very definitely regulate private property. I might come back to that. You might ask me questions instead. But what else does it do? It has to provide education for everybody. Education is the core of our capital. We, the people, are the basis of the wealth of our economy. Nothing else is, and educating people is absolutely fundamental, in my opinion, to doing that. We can't have competition in this process, in my opinion, not any effective competition. We have to have the best for everyone. Competition has inherent in it the concept of failure. In some things, they're just too important in life to have that idea of failure. Education is one, health is obviously another, and there are loads of other ones where, frankly, we can't duplicate resources. The idea that we have competition in the health service, for example, requires that every city, every town where there's a hospital should have at least two hospitals so that you can have competition and choice between them. Well, that's it. We can't adequately resource one hospital. We can't afford two with spare capacity so that everybody can actually decide where they're going. The alternative of that is that actually we get the American system, which of course is exactly what Lansky is trying to copy. 16% of GDP dedicated to health, worse overall health outcomes. We do better health outcomes overall on half the GDP dedicated to the purpose, precisely because we don't have competition. So there's some things that should definitely be done in that part of the economy, the black coffee bit of the economy. But I actually also believe that we need this relationship between that black coffee part of the economy and some...
What's that, Eric? Right.
Technical problems.
We haven't got a blind. That's Skype. Okay, that's not our fault. Screw you, Skype.
Yeah, I'm still going.
There we go. Yeah.
Sorry about that, Richard. We just lost you for 2 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. Richard, can you restart your video?
All the videos turned off. I'm back on. I can't see you guys. But if I hear some noise, I'll keep going.
Here you are, Richard. Can you see us now?
There you go. Hello.
Thank just you. Keep going. Please continue.
The interlude. Hey, Richard. How did that happen?
Don't worry about it.
I was just saying, we then need to have a private sector as well. I believe that ownership by people of business is going to carry on, but it has to be well regulated. And that is the white frothy milk which goes on the top of the black coffee. A lot of the things made by the private sector are absolutely fundamental. I don't think the state should be making bread, frankly. We saw what happened when the state tried to make bread in... it didn't really work very well. The private sector should be making bread. Bread is one of the great joys in life, and I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be made by people in bakeries. But what we do need to do is fundamentally regulate that. And what we also need to do is look at actually the part of consumption which is heavily promoted excessively, which is, you know, the chocolate on the top. That's if you like, your weekend colour supplement bit. Everything you don't need, but are told you want by the whole advertising industry. An industry that is there to push people into debt, to push people into the arms of financial services, to make sure at the end of the day that people are kept in place by a society which forces them through advertising to have wants they don't need and debt that they don't have to suffer, to make sure that they are actually kept as servants or even slaves of a system, which is where we've reached and which has led us to such a disastrous position. A few more exceptions of the metaphor. We have to have the right mix between the state and the private sector. Well, that's the spoon, that's democracy. Sugar is some of the sweeteners that make sure that the outliers will stay in place. And very importantly, you know, the saucer is the welfare state, which is absolutely critical to make sure that nobody falls through the cracks. And yet we're losing that whole idea of what the welfare state, the social security system, which is much more important than the welfare state, perhaps sort of just definition. We're losing that whole idea that it's actually about supporting and holding people and making sure they're protected. And I'm really sort of, you know, I think that's a real negative. So my belief is that we have this very different perception of what we need from an economy. And in that economy, people would have to come first. And that means that actually, far from having a world where we don't have enough regulation, we actually need a world where there's a lot more regulation. I mean, I've looked at some of the regulation that's in place right now, and you know, we spend a lot of time attacking the Corporation of London. Remember, corporations are the very artificial entities which are being put together to allow people to exploit other people. And companies are a particularly important problem here. There are 2.8 or so million companies in the UK right now. In any year, around 500,000 of those might disappear from view. Literally disappear. They're struck off and they're unaccountable, and we don't ask them to do tax returns. To give you a simple idea, in 2009-10 tax year, when I did a lot of research on this issue, of the 2.8 million companies in the UK, for some reason we only asked 1.9 million to send in a tax return, which is extraordinary. Of that 1.9 million who actually sent in a tax return, or were asked to send in a tax return, only 1.2 million did. And of those, only 900,000 actually paid tax. So only one in three companies actually pay tax. We've ended up in a situation where we basically have a voluntary taxation system for companies in this country. Now that's how corrupted is our market system. You know, David Cameron tells us that all we need is a few better, you know, rules and, you know, the framework. Matthew Hancock MP, you know, big influence on George Osborne, was saying on Friday, all we need is a slightly better framework and all would be well. You can be sure that that framework is going to be actually run by the mates for the mates, the chums regulating the chums, as I put it, you know, the 1% for the 1%. Well, it isn't working. And what we need to do is actually have a system which stands up and says, yeah, we need a strong foundation for the state, we need to ensure all the basics are met, we should be allowing people the freedom to trade for themselves and for their own private profit. I mean, I can't, you know, say otherwise. I've been self-employed now for 27 years, that's more than half my life. And the idea that I could be employed by anybody is beyond imagination. I'm utterly unemployable by now, and I suspect I'm not the only person around who probably feels like that. I'm sure some of you are probably utterly unemployable too. And I call it, you know, that's a benefit, that's not a weakness in life. Because your opinions are probably good. Well, that freedom requires us to have that right to work for ourselves. But it's inside an incredibly different foundation of what the state does. So, you know, I wanted to talk about this idea of what I think beyond capitalism is, and actually, you know, I hate to say it, in a sense, it's a form of capitalism, but it actually is something that we lost sight of, which existed in, to some extent, from 1945 through to about 1973, and that was, of course, a mixed economy. It was the period of greatest growth the UK has seen. It was when more people actually got houses which were decent to live in than we'd ever managed before, when we actually freed an awful lot of women from the drudgery of, you know, the slave labour of being in the home, and things transformed. We saw real change in society. People, you know, claimed things for themselves. And then it all went wrong because neoliberalism said, hang on, they're getting too free, we want to enslave them in a different way. And debt was the way they were enslaved. It is literally the rise of the enforced slavery of debt, promoted through advertising, through overconsumption, that's been there. So this is my view in the book, is incredibly green. I'm one of the authors of something called The Green New Deal, which had quite a lot of influence in 2008. We wrote about the failure of the economy before Lehman Brothers fell over, which gave us a certain sort of kudos. We'd actually put in the recovery plan. We'd recommended the recovery plan before we'd even had the failure in a very real way. And other people in that group are people like, well, Larry Elliott on The Guardian, Anne Pettifor, Colin Hines, an environmentalist, Jerry Leggett, who was at Greenpeace, now heavily into solar energy, and people like that. Caroline Lucas is also a member of the group. When she was still an MEP, not an MP, she began to write with us. And Caroline is perhaps my example at the moment of somebody who is a courageous politician. Because she's been willing to stand out against the crowd. She's been willing to put forward the alternative argument. She hasn't been cowed into following the basic line. Well, my fear is, let's be blunt about it, and I talk to them quite often, that the Labour Party has at the moment been forced back into that position of agreeing that we can't do anything because the market says we can't. It would result in a very different view of how we look at the economy, and people often ask me, what would you do to change things right now? I'm going to stop on suggesting just what those three things are. I would be looking right now that we have a situation where we have 2.8 or so million people unemployed in this country. As many people unemployed as we have companies, by a curious coincidence. I think that's the biggest scandal of all time. People who want to work and can't work is a travesty of justice. They're being denied the chance to work. There is the biggest waste of resources. I mean, and all these people are trained. Every one of those cases is a tragedy, in my view. So we need to get people back to work. There are three ways to do that. One is to tackle something I call the tax gap. We hear from George Osborne that we have a deficit this year of £120 billion, and this is a crisis for the UK, and he's got to cut as a result. Well, the fact is that we actually have £70 billion of tax evasion in this country at the moment. That's people who deliberately evade the tax that they owe and don't pay it. We've got £25 billion of tax avoidance. That's people, like especially large companies and the wealthy, who pay accountants and lawyers to create schemes to get around paying tax. And there's actually also £25 billion on average of tax paid late. Add those together and they happen, by curious coincidence again, to come to £120 billion, which is the annual deficit. Now, I'm not pretending we can close the whole deficit by collecting unpaid tax. We can't. It wouldn't happen. But we could certainly collect some of it and begin to tackle the problem. Secondly, we have our pension funds being captured by the City of London. There's £80 billion of people's money goes into pension funds each year in the UK. At a cost of state subsidy of £37 billion a year, and well over 90% of money. Most likely, up to 99% of that money is used for speculation in the City of London. So our money, you know, if you're in a pension fund or you know somebody's in a pension fund, that money is being used to go into a pension fund which is being used for speculation. I argue that actually one quarter of all money going into pension funds, that's £20 billion a year, could instead be invested in the creation of jobs in the UK. This would be green infrastructure in particular. It would be greening our economy. It would be making the new sort of society that we need to be sustainable in the long term, which provides us with a return, a saving in particular of energy costs, which would then actually allow a rate of return to be paid on that money, which would make it viable in the long term. So pensioners would have their funds invested in ensuring that there are jobs available until people reach retirement age, which at the moment seems pretty damn unlikely for a lot of people. And lastly, I would actually be saying that, you know, the government has issued £275 billion of new money over the last 2.5 years to keep the banks afloat in quantitative easing. And what if we could issue £275 billion to keep the banks afloat? And I think we should certainly be able to issue £20 billion a year to also support a programme of job creation as well. If I took the closing the tax gap, reforming pensions so they had to invest in job creation, and a programme of green quantitative easing, I could put £60 billion back into our economy each year to make sure that we can actually create a viable economy for the long term, which would mean that we can have the public services we want, We could generate the wealth to pay for them. We wouldn't be facing a crisis of cuts, cuts, cuts. We'd actually be looking at a situation where we'd be transforming the future of our economy for the benefit of everybody of all generations. And as a result, I believe we could actually have a social market economy, a mixed economy, which would deliver the well-being that we need to ensure that in the long term, we can have what I call, the courageous state, which would actually be the basis of true prosperity, which is people living in constraints, the natural constraints that do really apply to us. We could meet our needs. We would, I fully admit, supply fewer of our wants. But frankly, most of our wants are pretty damned artificial anyway. And beyond books, what does anybody need apart from bread and a good social life? That's a particularly biased view of life that I point forward there, because books are my, I suppose, my fetish. You can see some behind me. But that's my view. But that's me talking for enough. Let's move to some questions.
Okay, I'm not quite sure how we're going to manage the questions. Can somebody just speak out from the audience and see if Richie can hear you? Have you got a question?
Yeah, okay, part of our process of managing questions.
Okay, I can do the mic check.
If you want.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to have a question here.
Yeah. Chris from Occupy Norwich. Bit worried about what you said.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. About women being liberated from drudgery in the home. In these sort of golden eras in the middle of the last century. I used to teach child psychology, and I'm a bit worried that a lot of working women go out to work when the children are too young. The system is set up that way. They get maternity benefits, what is that, 9 months or something like that. Children need consistent one-on-one care till they're about three. Now, I don't want to sort of chain women to the kitchen sink, but how about having women and men, mothers and fathers, working part-time? Let's work a lot less. I mean, nowadays, when I was young, mothers did not work, by and large. Nowadays, you need both, in most cases, mother and father, both going out to work to pay the mortgage. So we need to kind of get back to working less and looking after the kids and having fun much more.
Can I just say there are alternative views here?
Chris, I couldn't agree with you more.
But there are people who agree as well.
Yeah. Any more questions?
Okay, come here, turn to you.
Any more questions from Richard, from the people? Okay.
Can I hear that alternative view that somebody wanted to put?
Do you want to put your alternative view?
Okay. I think we need a courageous state where the well-being of children is very important, and how that can be managed with both men and women being able to nurture and not place responsibility solely on women. There's also some very good research, I'm a child psychologist, some very good research is about the quality of the relationship between parents and children that matter, not the actual quantity of time. So we need all of that knowledge shared, and we need a society that does prioritise children and is seen as a responsibility of both the state and men and women to rear children well.
Okay, any reply to that, Richard?
I'm no expert on this, except that I'm a dad, and the reason why I'm not with you today in part is that because I've committed to actually be with my 9 and 10-year-old sons, so that's most of my experience of this. And I treat that as an incredibly important part of my duty as a parent. And I will tell you that, actually, we've always managed to work it, that one of the reasons I work at home quite a bit is that actually I play a full part in child caring. I do more of the journeys to and from school and more of the after school time than my wife does. But she plays her role on 2 days a week, so we try to balance up and have always tried to make sure that there's being parents around. So I believe very strongly in the idea that actually we need to reassess how much we need to work. Well, that also means we need to reassess how much we need to consume. I mean, I'm a Quaker, one of the things that Quakers will always talk about is living simply, and actually that means deciding what is really important to consume and what is not. I'm not proselytizing for any form of faith, by the way. That's not part of my faith system. It's part of my actual belief system is that we definitely over-consume. And if we consume less, there's, I think, not a shadow of a doubt we could spend more time with our children, who certainly, in my case, have been the most... complete revelation of joy, which I didn't become a dad until I was 43. And I'm quite glad I delayed it, by the way, but I don't recommend that to everyone because I just really enjoyed it so much since I have been. But it does mean we need to actually reappraise two things. One, what is work for? And I think that the New Economics Foundation has been doing some really interesting discussions, probably being a bit provocative, talking about a 21-hour week for everyone. I'm not sure that a 21-hour week works for everyone, by the way. If I was to be going into hospital and having a surgeon working on me, I have to confess I wouldn't want a 21-hour a week surgeon. That's the sort of job that requires someone to do vast amounts of it, from what I'm told by some friends who are surgeons. So, some jobs just do demand that sort of complete dedication, and they're very strange, but most jobs don't do that. Let's be blunt about it. Most jobs don't require that at all. So, we need to seriously rethink flexibility about the working week, our working patterns. But also, we need to actually, and neoliberalism has been a disaster for this, we need to rethink about what it means to be in community. Because fundamentally, neoliberalism is about us as isolated individuals. And we never used to live as isolated individuals at one time. We lived in extended families or extended communities in which fathers played a much, and men played a much bigger role in childcare. And I think all that needs to be reviewed as well. And it's pretty depressing. I mean, Chris, you talk about being your role as a professional with children. Yeah, but how many men are there in primary schools as role models now? That's also quite rare as well. So we need to break down loads of stereotypes like that. And this is part of what we need to explore about the value of community. And in the book, I build in the whole idea of emotional life and intellectual life and our purpose as well as our material well-being in economics. It's a brave attempt. I don't know if it works, but I certainly don't think that economics is just about meeting our material well-being. I definitely think it's about our communities and more than that as well.
Richard, we've got another question here from Sam Artecki.
Okay. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining us. I'm an electronic engineer and among other things, an inventor. And I was very interested to hear...
Sorry, I can't hear you very well.
I was very interested to hear that... So I said I'm an electronic engineer and inventor, and I was very interested to hear that green technology was part of your recovery strategy or part of your thinking. I'd like to tell you what that is, tangibly, what we actually have.
Sure.
And what I learned at university was that my professors don't talk about these technologies. These things aren't taught. These are very much in the open source community. In the open source community, they exist online, and they exist with other makers as part of a maker movement, a hackspace movement. And these designs and techniques exist as sort of hobbyist things. And they haven't necessarily all broken into the mainstream yet. But it will be very small scale, lots of individuals running, their custom little solar rigs and bicycle generators. And what I'd like to say is that at Occupy, one of the things that I believe in is digital empowerment and open source green technology. And we're trying to innovate and actually put together small systems which are self-contained and quite evidently give out a lot of energy or very practical, very robust solutions. What I wonder is, do you think it's going to be the big, the government leading the charge, solutions through industry? Because I have to tell you, I'm a Durham graduate. I don't believe the crap I hear from the government. They're not investing in the right technologies. And I assume they're advised by engineers too. So what the hell's going on? I don't believe in them to the extent that I seek Occupy as an alternative vehicle to actually achieve social change through promoting inventions. And I give away all of my intellectual property because I believe that it's the only way to actually achieve change. So you must understand, I will not add my value to the economy if I don't believe, if I believe there's corruption at a higher level where literally good ideas are being ignored and not adopted on a wide scale where they could have been. And I know that's an oversimplification, but some good ideas were just tossed out and continue to be tossed out and never make the big time, probably due to vested interests. I just wondered what your take was on that.
Do I deal with that one first, or are there any other questions?
Yeah, we'll deal with that one first. It's quite a long one to deal with, I think.
Well, I have to say I agree with you to a very large degree. I'm frequently asked why have I written, and I'm not sure how many it is now, but it's something like 8,000 blog posts over the last few years. I appear to have no funding for that, so why am I doing that? Well, because I give away my intellectual property for free, pretty much, it's fair to say, because I found that that works. I always be involved in it in a sense, because ideas are simply don't need to be constrained. Ideas need to be shared, and that's how they work. And the return is the fact that we see that we're all in work and working in community. Most of the whole process that we're looking at, which is actually why I have real problems with the Green Deal that the government is now talking about and its concept of a green investment bank, is about promoting ideas where intellectual property is captured in patent rights, which are then withheld from others, which are then ensured that there's a profit stream which is going to go back to capital and is not about actually delivering the real returns to society, which we're looking at. If we were really interested in doing some radical stuff, we'd be talking about some very different ideas indeed. Some of them would be quite controversial. I mean, one of the projects that I like is a guy who put forward the idea of actually having a communally owned dam across the Wash, because there are actually millions of people who are threatened by global warming and the rise in the sea level from the Wash, which is near where I live. But you can also generate enormous amounts of tidal power. The amount of bulk not beyond imagination, but return should be the public sector return for the public good, protecting people so that we have a long-term future for a whole part of the UK and agriculture within it. So, you know, we need to rethink this. If we don't actually radically change the way in which we think about ownership of technology, as well as just about its viability, then we don't go forward. And I believe that in funding small business, people to innovate in small scale, with the outcomes being deliberately shared. I mean, where we provide someone with a livelihood, but we don't give them the opportunity to capture, as a result of that livelihood, a profit stream forever for their future generation,
Richard,
then I think, you know, we're failing badly.
Richard,
so
can I ask a green
investment bank has to think differently.
We've got some more questions. Can I just ask people to keep their questions very short? Because we've only got about five minutes left, Richard, so this will get them here.
Of the 120 billion, can you hear me?
Can you hear Tim, Richard?
I pushed my volume up as high as possible.
Okay, just going to the mic.
It would help, sorry.
Of the 120 billion, you said that 20 billion could be claimed back somehow.
Okay, of the 120 billion in unpaid taxes, okay, you said that 20 billion could be claimed back quite easily. And I suppose the 100 billion would never be claimed back. What's the actual mechanism or process for doing that?
For claiming the money back. Look, I mean, I'm not going to over egg the cake by saying that we can get back 60 million when, you know, everybody tells me we can't get back 1 billion of it. So most people think I'm mad to claim 20 billion can be recovered. But let's look at very simply at this. Over the last 7 years, the number of people working at HM Revenue and Customs has been reduced from 100,000 to 65,000. And by 2015, it's scheduled to be reduced to 50,000. Now, we're told debt is the biggest crisis we face by neoliberal politicians, and they're basically sacking the debt collectors if you clear the problem. Yeah, there's absolutely no logic to what they're doing. Like it or not, a lot of taxes are recovered by one-to-one interventions. People on the ends of telephones saying, pay your tax, and people actually basically investigating those who are corrupt. Staggeringly, we've only recently discovered there are only 2,000 fully qualified tax inspectors working for HM Revenue and Customs in total out of their staff. Those are the people who take on the really difficult cases. Yeah, the Vodafones and the Goldman Sachs and the Barclays and all those others who are the really heavy abusers. Just 2,000 of them. Lined up against them, 15,000 members of the Chartered Institute of Tax, 135,000 chartered accountants, not all of whom do tax. But on and on, you know, massive ranks of people who look a bit like me because, well, I'm a chartered accountant, and then grey hair and getting older. But, you know, spend their lives trying to beat the tax system. Well, you know, we've got to have enough resources to challenge them. If we put back 20,000 people into the revenue, it cost $1 billion a year, and I reckon the payback would be 20 billion. You know, why would you turn down a free effective 19 billion and 20,000 people at work and the opportunity to spend that money on preserving ourselves against cuts? It just is bizarrely mad logic. But even Ed Balls doesn't buy it at the moment, I'll tell you.
Richard.
I just don't
get it. Richard, just got time for one more question, I think. This gentleman over here.
Look, if you want.
Sorry?
I could do slightly longer. I can do till quarter to six.
Well, we do have another session starting upstairs, so I just want to keep it short.
Different.
Okay, okay.
Your book is called The Courageous Politician. How do you make...
Courageous State.
The Courageous State. How do you make politicians courageous? I suspect that there are two things. One is the way parties are funded. The other is the revolving door for politicians. But do you have your own suggestions about how we can get politicians out from under big business?
Look, at the moment, as I say, the whole idea of neoliberalism is to tell them that everything they do is a negative. They can only make us worse off by intervening in the economy. That's the fundamental basis on which neoliberalism works. Well, that's obviously wrong. So what we have to do is actually create a different narrative. You know, an alternative economic story. I mean, this is what Occupy is about, I think. This is what, you know, why I was so excited when UK Uncut came on the scene. It's why I've been so excited by Occupy. We're joining together. I mean, I've now been to London and Bank of Ideas and to Norwich and where I've seen Chris. And, you know, I would quite like to be up, except, you know, dad duties sort of conflict today. But, you know, what we've got to actually come up with, and my contribution is the book, to try and talk about how we can have a different world. And, you know, I look at the books that have influenced me, F. Schumacher in 1975, or, you know, one of my early economic readings, and I realise that there isn't just one view, which is what we're told time and time again by the neoliberals, that, you know, there's only one way of doing this. Actually, there are others. I don't pretend I know the answer to that question. What I do know, what I know from being involved in Occupy, is that a lot of us have the confidence to think there is an alternative. You know, Tina is dead. Let's put Tina in her box, I'm afraid, and, you know, put her away forever. Because there is an alternative. It's actually Occupy. You know, we're talking about something that we can do differently. What we have to have is the confidence to go out there and say to people, it is possible to do things differently and persuade politicians. And this is why I think Caroline Lucas is a good example. She has been willing to stand up and say, I think it's possible to do something differently. And those people who believe that need to be in government saying, look, I've been given a mandate. I've been trusted by people to make a judgment. I don't know all the answers. I will make mistakes, inevitably. You know, the neoliberals do as well. They claim they know the future. Well, they obviously don't. But we need to have people who will say, I trust my judgment, and this is my vision, this is my story, this is the world I want to create, and it's a world where everyone can achieve to their best potential. My definition of economic success is a world where everybody can achieve to their best potential. We're all born with the opportunity to achieve our potential to its limit. Our potentials are different. We won't have the same outcomes because I really value the fact that some people view the world very differently from me, have different skills from me, can deliver different things from me. That's fantastic. It's that diversity which is the basis of the foundation of community. But I want everybody to have their chance to deliver whatever they're good at to the best of their ability. And if we have politicians who set out with that goal to liberate the world so people have that chance, that's my understanding of an equal society, everybody has to do whatever they're best at and be fairly rewarded for it.
Richard,
that's
just
my vision.
Richard,
that's what I want.
If I can just interrupt, I'm just going to put a suggestion to people. There is a session upstairs going on about the future of the occupied movement. I'm not quite sure what time that starts. I think they're going to delay it because of this being delayed. I'm going to suggest that if people want to go to that, and if we carry on with the discussion for people who want to carry on speaking to you for a bit. Would that be okay for another 10 minutes or so?
That's okay for me.
Yeah, okay. So if you want to stay here and carry on talking to Richard, we'll go upstairs for the Future of the Occupy Movement session.
To those who get up, cheerio.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, yeah, sorry, there's a lady around here that has a question for you. It's Deepti.
Hi there, it's
Hello.
Sheffield, Deepa. Hi, Richard. I just wondered what your views of the impending euro collapse were.
I remember a long time ago, God, I actually wiped my eyes thinking about it, 1977, a very wise lecturer saying, actually, we don't need one currency even for a country, we might need multiple countries for a currency. to deal with all the different needs we have. And I really think that one of the things we're going to have to think about is not just an alternative to banking, but how we do genuinely create multiple currencies. Because I think that's maybe one of the ways in which we can actually liberate the sort of exchanges that we need, but which we haven't got a vision for as yet. And obviously we do have some alternative currencies, you know, the local LEC schemes and things already. What's going to happen with the euro? I don't know. I wish I did. I mean, to be completely dishonest with me to give you an answer. We've never been through a situation where we have seen the sort with this, you know, weekend supposedly Greece is going to survive again. Well, maybe Greece will, but what happens when Italy can't refinance? I don't know. If we do face potential economic collapse, my suspicion is that at the end of the day, that isn't going to happen. I think that we will find the European Central Bank is simply going to print the money to keep the system going. It's what's happened here, remember. The reason why the UK has actually been able to survive relatively well during this crisis is that so far we've issued £275 billion of debt. You know, the deficit for the last 2 years has actually been £276 billion. Do you see any coincidence between those numbers? Because I sure as heck do. What's actually happening is that the government is simply printing money to pay for our deficit right now. What isn't happening in Europe is that the European Central Bank, because of Germany's influence, is letting cash be issued to actually deal with the crisis. If it was issued to deal with the crisis, we wouldn't have the problem. We'd be having the money going straight back into central banks, and we would have the breathing space we needed to deal with this, but the Germans are the problem in this respect. We could solve it if only Germany would let that money be printed. We could then go through a transition to the point where we could actually get over this crisis. But eventually, we're going to have to break up the currencies. There's no two ways around it. You can't have all those people with the same currencies. It creates a pressure which is unmanageable. And it's pretty much like the dire situation that France got itself into in the 1930s by staying on the gold standard. So the gold standard, for anybody who thinks it's an alternative, is definitely not. We have to have government-controlled money actually under central control and the benefit of money creation being reclaimed by the state again. That was a long-winded answer. Still say I don't know the solution.
Sorry, another question? Yeah.
Hi, Richard. Just leading on from that, what do you think about ideas like the Venus Project and Free World Charter, for example? Because for me, it's just a matter of time before we have to...
I didn't hear the last bit of the question.
I was just saying, yeah, what do you think about ideas like the Venus Project and the Free World Charter? Because it's going to become essential for our survival at some point, using resources as a base for our economy.
I'll be honest, I don't know either of those projects in detail, so I can't answer the question. So I'm afraid to say I'm a failure there.
Okay. All right.
But if you want to stick the links, I'll look at them.
Yeah. Well, the Venus Project by Jack Fresco. The Free World Charter.
I think I've seen that, and I think I quite like the idea I saw in there. But the Venus Project, I'll have a look.
Yeah. The basic same concept. The Venus Project is a bit more sort of in-depth and has like a design as well and stuff. It's been a pet hobby of Jack's for years. But for me, money, I mean, you know, we all know it's a fiat currency. It has no place in our society. I think it's out of date, to be honest with you. It's just what we're accustomed to.
I would argue, and I do in my book, that obviously the reclaiming of the right to make money by government and actually to provide some real substance of value to it as a result and to actually take that away from the banks is absolutely critical. Absolutely. It's fundamental. Yeah. We need a medium for exchange, but we've definitely got the wrong one right now.
There was a... Graham Kerr has written a paper recently which has looked at the misrepresentation of profits in companies. I don't know if you've come across it.
Yes, I do.
And would you concur with his findings on that?
Look, there's a whole range of work being done on this, and actually I was quite involved with making some representations to the House of Lords with a chap called Tim Bush, who I think also knows Graham Kerr, about, you know, the fact that banks massively overstated profits completely artificially, and that we've actually ended up with a situation where because companies, and particularly the big four firms of accountants, write the rules for accounting, we saw vast amounts of profit recorded which never really existed over the last decade. This is a fraud. I mean, let's be blunt about it. And some of us have been saying it for a long time. I'm one of them. a chap called Professor Prem Sikka at Essex University. If you haven't come across his work, he's a great socialist and he's a great thinker on alternatives in accounting. And he has an excellent Marxist narrative on this, which I don't always share, but I think Prem is fantastic in challenging the whole concept of profit, how we come up with it, and why it's only the return to capital which is of importance. You know, why can't we prepare a set of accounts which actually makes the focus the return to labour? You know, why not? We could do. The same as we can challenge concepts of ownership, we can actually challenge the whole concept of what reward we're trying to maximise inside this. There's no reason why it has to be profit per se, but profit, because it became the thing that was the focus of attention, has been manipulated. And the reason why that is that we've actually let a tiny minority of those in employment, who are called the directors of companies, distort the whole situation, pay themselves rewards, and to achieve their share option schemes, which have given them these enormous overinflated bonuses and payments, which are utterly destroying equality inside our society. They have distorted the whole measurement of profit to make sure they get their bonus schemes come hell or high water. That's not chance, that's deliberate, that's capture of the whole regulatory system by a tiny minority whose interests have been served by it, and as a result, profit has been massively distorted in all sorts of absurd ways. I mean, I can explain one of those. You know, when a company actually makes a loss, the value of its debt goes down, and mysteriously, companies are allowed to record that as a profit in their accounts because they can rebuy their debt more cheaply. And last year, nearly £1 billion of profit was recorded in Royal Bank of Scotland for that reason. I mean, that was fake, false profit accounting to make sure that now we're going to see the chairman of RBS or the chief executive of RBS get a bonus of well over £1 million as a result. This is just absolutely disgusting. It's capture for capture's sake. So the idea that profits are false is undoubtedly true. We need to rethink accounting as part of this whole process. And a very few of us trying to do that.
Right, okay. Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you, I'm glad it worked.
You can see me now. Just. Richard,
I can see you too.
Richard, it's been a pleasure having you here at Occupy. We'd love to see you in person sometime. I know the technology is just about working for us today. Bit touch and go. But thank you very much. Okay, have a good evening.
Yes, and you, thank you.